Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 19th of October. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
How's life treating you, Kev? How's your week been?
Good. Jonathan Swan's been here all week. We've been on the Mediterranean, chilling out, and we're about.
I see he's been buying some silver. I saw a cheeky little photo. Have you been giving him the old silver bug treatment?
He's been buying that silver from me personally.
Oh, is he?
We couldn't get it. I had to put an order in, and it's another 3 weeks to get it. So I gave him some of the silver I had, and he's taken that back.
Yeah, you're brave. The rate is going up. You better buy that quickly.
No, I've bought it, but okay. I've only got a piece of paper to say I've bought it. We've been having a good time and doing a bit of work as well, obviously, in the meantime. But, the weather's been nice. We were in the Mediterranean a few times in the sea. It was a bit cool, but nice. We're actually going, by the time you've listened to this, you'll hear. But tonight we're going to see that first movie I ever saw at the cinema. I think it was 1977.
Let me guess. Is it Jaws?
No.
Oh, another one. Oh, I know that it might be Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
No.
Ooh.
Greece is the word.
Greece.
It's the most.
No, I was thinking Star Wars as well around that era, 77, because that's Star Wars. And you're telling me it's Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta.
We're going to watch it in an open cinema in the middle of a Wadi desert in just outside Cairo with food and stuff. And we're going to go and watch Greece, that movie.
That'll be good, actually. That will be good. I mean, if you know all the songs, Summer Loving and all that lot. And
Summer Loving happens so fast.
Very good. Okay, yeah.
So the world is a bit strange. We now, after speaking with Rick Rule last week, gold has now hit 4,300. Silver's going to the moon because there isn't any of it left. Nobody's buying any. I don't think you can buy it.
But nobody's producing. No, and everybody wants to take physical.
The interesting thing was I listened to a few podcasts, and you know what the problem is? The problem is not the ore. The ore is available. The problem is there isn't enough processing capacity to keep up with demand. So they can't physically make the silver from the ore. So until that is solved, and that's not an overnight problem. That's years of problem to try and get enough silver to be produced with this demand. What's going to happen? The price is just going to keep on going up. It can't do anything else. And this price that we read on the futures is a load of crap. You can't even buy it this price.
Yeah.
The real price is around,
you can add another $20 onto that for physical at least.
The physical I bought in dollar terms was about 67, I think it was, on Thursday. Yeah, so it doesn't make any sense. The price they're quoting 53 or 52 or whatever, it's a joke.
Absolutely. And then obviously we've seen big news this week. It's all about the Israel-Hamas ceasefire. Obviously on the 10th of October, we saw the US brokered ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Obviously remaining fragile, but largely holding after sort of six, seven days. The agreement, obviously part of President Trump's 20-point peace plan, began with a phased withdrawal of Israeli forces from parts of Gaza in exchange for Hamas releasing all remaining living Israeli hostages and the remains of the deceased ones. Obviously, this is the first major halt in the two-year war that began with Hamas's October 7th, 2023 attack on Israel, which killed 1,144 people and led to over 67,000 Palestinian deaths in Gaza. So what do you make? I mean, obviously, we saw the 20 remaining living Israeli hostages return. Very emotional scenes there within those for 72 hours of that, followed by the remains of 28 deceased captives believed to be held in Gaza. Obviously, that progress has been partial. We've seen about sort of four or five of the bodies returned. I think one of them was deemed to actually not be one of them. It was a Palestinian body that was actually. So, I mean, could you imagine that, having to actually hunt through rubble because they don't know the whereabouts of a lot of those bodies? I mean, so we've seen frantically Hamas running out to all the devil. There's bulldozers been there trying to find the deceased. I mean, what an operation. It's like finding a needle in a haystack, surely, under all that rubble.
Yeah, I think they promised what they couldn't deliver, to be honest. It's scary.
Do you think it's going to hold, I guess, is the question that I say on everyone's lips, this, or do you think that?
I think it will, and I think it will on due of threat, basically, because I think if it doesn't hold, I think, Gaza will be obliterated by the Americans.
I mean, seeing Hamas there out in the street with their guns, I mean, I thought part of it was they were going to disarm, but it doesn't appear. And they're already shooting up some local kind of militia or anybody who kind of doesn't fit in. They say that they're sympathizing with Israel. So they're very much being staunch hardline. But do you think that Israel, that Hamas are going to, I mean, I thought the whole point of Israel's going into Gaza was to wipe Hamas off the face of the earth.
Well, it was, but I mean, ultimately, I think they realized being a sort of underground terrorist organization
Not
that
going to
isn't
happen.
possible. You can't knock the commitment or the soul out of people. You can't do it.
No.
We've seen that in history repeated multitude of times in different situations. If you kill somebody, how many more are coming behind them? I mean, you've killed 67,000 Palestinians. How many more people have you created who want revenge or want vengeance or whatever it happens to be? It's ludicrous. I mean, I hope that in whatever way it happens, that Hamas disarm and, the people of Gaza can get on with it. I mean, the reality is that they've lived in that situation, and a huge number of them are sympathetic to Hamas. There is no doubt about that. But I don't know. I think we're going to see movements. I think things are going to happen. It wouldn't surprise me if a small amount of Egypt also becomes part of the Palestinian state. Wouldn't surprise me. There are a lot of things I think that are going to happen and move and shift slightly, even if it's only a few kilometers of ground, to just make the whole thing more viable. Maybe I'm speaking out of turn there. That's definitely not in the press or anything in Egypt, but I can see the way Sisi, who's the president of Egypt, has been involved, that they want to make it work, so it's a long-term solution this time. And I think it will. I think it will. I think Israel's been stopped, if you want the honest truth. I think basically Trump says, right, enough is enough, and you got to
I think
stop
you're
this.
right, and I think that when you see the reaction when Trump stood up in the Knesset and he made his speech and everyone gave him a standing ovation, he's got way more respect from the local, from the Israelis in the government than Netanyahu. Like Netanyahu was almost booed out of the place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, Netanyahu basically should be in jail if he wasn't the prime minister or whatever it is, the president. But yeah,
And then we've got, I
that's.
guess we've got everyone seeing whether now Trump's focusing on, obviously he's got the meeting with Zelensky today on Friday. He's had a very good conversation apparently with Putin about potentially ending things there. He's also almost threatening the obviously Ukraine have recently mentioned that they want the US to supply them with these Patriot, these cruise missiles, these Tomahawks, which can obviously reach further into Moscow territory or Russian territory and take out some of the strategic targets, whether they be airfields or power sites. What do you make of that? Do you think he's got the ability to then now negotiate a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia?
I hope so, but let's see. Meanwhile, everybody in the world is realizing that the US dollar's going to crap, and the dollars or the gold's going up, the silver's going up, we look like copper's going up. And the one thing that is going to be moving forward, because we're all starting to use it more on a daily basis, is AI. And what people I don't think quite realize is, if this has to expand, the infrastructure required for AI is vast. Do you know any companies that might be involved in that?
Well, I guess we can move on to our first guest this week, and it's a debut appearance for Paul Elliott, CEO of Active Energy Group, and Adrian Gleave, AG's Chief Strategy Officer. Welcome to the podcast, gents. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for having us. Good morning.
Absolutely,
Good
yeah.
morning, guys.
Yeah, so for those of it who may not be familiar, Active Energy Group is an alternative energy company that's pivoted into one of the most exciting areas of the modern economy, sustainable digital infrastructure. The company is building modular, renewable-powered data sites designed to support the explosive demand from sectors like AI, blockchain, and high-performance computing. It's a smart, scalable model that combines clean energy with cutting-edge technology. Paul, let's start with a bit of background, please. So, for our listeners, can you just tell us about AEG's origins and how the company transitioned into this digital energy space, please?
Yeah, certainly. So originally they've been going for some 15, 20 years, and they have this license and technology and patents for Coleswitch, which again was great in concept. It works, but the implementation was a little bit more difficult. And they had one site going in North America. Coleswitch essentially is an alternative to coal, but it's very, very sustainable, and it is a white burn as well, so great for carbon, etc. We then got involved when it was suspended from the stock market. They'd run out of cash. We basically transitioned then to find a way forward for it, which we've done with obviously different routes into the energy sector.
Absolutely, yeah. And obviously, we just saw the recent news that you released a significant update confirming that 35% of your first 8 MW facility in the UAE has already been pre-sold before construction has even finished. So, huge vote of confidence there. Can you just talk us through the details of that announcement and why it's such an important milestone for the company?
Yeah, I think we've got to start looking at where we've come from, what's the reasoning why we're focused on digital infrastructure rather than Coleswitch or any of our other pillars. But as we all see in the news, all the big tech companies are moving aggressively into this space. They're deploying a significant amount of investment in data centers and, like you said, HPC. So we Or some of our background and our contacts, we identified very quickly that the UAE, A, was a pioneer within the crypto world, but more importantly, it had a significant amount of capacity for power. And we were able to plug into that sort of surplus or excess power and therefore deliver infrastructure at a low cost. So we pivoted into what we call Bitcoin mining, but quickly realized that the volatility in the mining sector isn't quite where we wanted to be. So we focused more on the infrastructure. We put modular units in, which allow us to offer that to the AI hosting teams and also the Bitcoin mining. We're just a digital infrastructure play with ultra low cost power, human capital, which we utilize from remote workers from around the world, and low cost rent.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheers for that. So just talk us through, because I mean, I don't think you've actually named specifically how how you're going to generate these assets. So you've obviously got, is it potentially solar power you just alluded to, natural gas fired power, waste heat or surplus
It's a
energy?
mixture of all sorts of power which is being developed out in the UAE. The UAE are always forward thinking. They build the infrastructure before they build the businesses out or the residential market. So they always put in water, gas, whatever they need to do. And that is the significant amount of capacity. So we just take that in at a low cost. It may come from solar, may come from gas, may come from whatever power source that they're using.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the RNS, it mentioned that the site is expected to generate around $3.5 million in annual revenues with kind of obviously strong 50% margins were mentioned. How does that feed into your, wider growth strategy and what makes the UAE such an attractive market for that kind of operation?
Well, again, as I said, we're the infrastructure play. So what we now need to do is build out enough infrastructure to attract larger clients. At the moment, we're at the sort of the bottom end tier of our clients who are looking for sort of the smaller clients. So if we build out the infrastructure to, let's say, 50 to 100 megawatt, we will then start to attract some of the bigger players who then can take more space from us. And that will fund the growth throughout.
So, Adrian, just to pull you back to the where is the electricity coming from? What deals does Active Energy have in place to make sure that the energy that is coming into these things is going to be profitable for Active Energy.
So it's just the cost of power and the way that we can host the miners or the hosting data and overlay it and wrap it with low-cost human capital. So it's long-term contracts that we get from the power companies where that power is ultimately generated. We just know that it's coming in from a number of sources.
Okay. And so the 3,500 annual revenue is based on the fact that the plan for this first scenario is 8 megawatts that's then being built, but you've applied that that becomes 33 megawatts. When do you expect that that will be okayed and that you'll be able to sort it out?
Okay, so it's 3.5 million of revenue, and the first 8 megawatt is already being built out now. So the infrastructure and the connections are already put in place. The upgrade, we have to apply to the power grid to get the substations upgraded and so forth. That's in the process as we speak. We haven't had any confirmation that we've got that, but we believe it will be here within before Christmas, at the same time that the 8 megawatt comes live.
So the 3.5 million revenue is on just 8 megawatts?
Correct.
Okay, so that puts a different slant on it. So you are talking then per megawatt that you produce in 437,000. $437,500 revenue per megawatt that you produce.
In essence, yes.
And then 50% margin on that.
Right.
That's correct.
So if you get this to 100 megawatts, you're going to have shed loads of cash.
I mean, that's the reason why there's so much focus on this sector and why large tech companies are pouring billions of dollars into this sector. The growth of AI over the last 6 months in itself has been exceptional, and the infrastructure isn't there. So at some point in the future, that may tail down. But as you're quite right, Kevin, there is a significant amount of revenue to be generated. So the cost, I think our USP, our low cost of entry, the fact that we don't build huge infrastructure as in data centers, we build it as we grow. This modular unit allows us to get a quick return on investment. So if in 2 to 3 years there is a price decrease on the within the capacity of AI, we'll be able to stand that and still generate revenue throughout.
Yeah, because part of the deal here is to get to 100 megawatts as quickly as possible and then move on to 300 megawatts, I presume, with the growth, as in with this revenue. I mean, 100 megawatts, you're talking about $87.5 million per annum of free cash flow. But surely in this fast-moving situation and arena, it's going to make sense to have funding partners to come in and get this 100 megawatts as quickly as possible. Is that something that you're planning on doing?
Absolutely, Kevin, and a great question, really. And that's what our next focus is. So I think what we needed to do is demonstrate proof of concept. So through the capital raise that we did not so long ago, we've been able to deploy that capital in the ground for the 8 megawatt. Once that starts to generate, I think we will then be on an accelerated growth curve, and we're going to need to fund that. So we're already out talking to particular debt funders and other equity providers. But you're right, there is a focus on getting that 100 megawatt in the ground. It's all been identified, so it's not as if we've got to go and find that. We have them in place. We're under contract with some of them. We've just got to start being able to find a stronger and longer term funding partner.
Yeah, I mean, and hopefully a non-dilutive funding partner effectively is what you'd be looking for, I presume.
Ideally, we're looking for debt, yes.
Yeah.
So the other thing, Kevin, is, as you identified early on in the conversation, it kicks off a lot of cash. So once you've got the opportunity to use that cash to then fund the next one and so forth and so forth.
Yeah. So if we're in a perfect world, in January you've got the 8 megawatts up and running and you should be producing somewhere in the region of $300,000 of revenue per month at that stage. So somebody's going to lend you a significant amount based on that, you would imagine.
We believe so. But again, as we all know, proof of concept is important. We've got to demonstrate that we can find execute and then generate those revenues. And that's why it's an important stage, early quarter one of 26, that is in place. But also as important as proof of concept is having a pipeline that is credible. So not only are we focusing on deployment, we're actually building that pipeline ready to go. And as I said before, we have identified up to about 100 megawatt. Some of them are similar size, 10 to 15 megawatt, but we've identified a 60 megawatt site, which we'll need a bit more work due diligence on, but we're very close to signing that off.
You are also correct, Kevin, in the fact that as of January, we are looking at having good revenue stream, all of which we are looking at plowing back into the next round again. Like Adrian's clearly pointed out, we're going to be hopefully being moving straight on to either the 25 megawatt, or alternatively, we've got another couple within the same pipeline.
Very good. So Alexandra, I'm not even going to try and pronounce the second name, is in the UAE. So
Yeah.
is she the only employee that you have there, or is it a team of people that?
Well, look, Kevin, I think the way that AEG has come around is certainly from the board's point of view, we like to try and keep the cost of the core, let's say, head office to a minimum. So therefore, we try and partner with people where we're not taking on board that cost until we've actually generating real revenue, because we're looking to our shareholders to help fund these projects. And what we don't want to be doing, we want to get maximum shareholder value by deploying rather than paying, let's say, operational costs.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to be going out to the UAE. So hopefully I can meet Alexandra in the next few weeks when I go out, and she can show me what's going on. But from the point of view of this, if you execute this, your market cap of 3.5 million is comical, really.
First of all, I think it's comical at the moment. We've got more than that in current assets that on our balance sheet. One of the things that we did take over from the previous management team, we sat on about £3 million of stock of another company. But taking that to one side, you're absolutely right. If we can deliver this first 8 megawatt, we can then demonstrate that we've got a clear pipeline for 100 megawatt, and we bring on board a strategic funding partner. And I believe we could deliver that 100 megawatt within 9 to 12 months. Because of the way that we've structured the business, we're able to, it's a modular deployment. So as soon as we get confirmation we've got access to power, we then can deploy the infrastructure. And very quickly, we will be at 100 megawatt, generating a significant amount of cash. Yes, our probably cost of operations may go up, but it won't be significant because, again, as I said before, we try and use partners all the way through. So as our revenue cost, it's just a cost of revenue rather than a fixed cost. And then by that time, if we can put the 300 megawatt pipeline together, we're in a completely different phase of our growth.
Yeah, and then I presume you've got other countries as well that you can go to. I'm intrigued by what you said. You got 3 million in stock in another company. What is that, and is it listed, or is it an unlisted entity?
No, it's an unlisted.
So it's an unlisted company called Alpha Prospects. They've got, well, they quote their own value at 97 million. They've got a lot of clever inventions and patents, etc. It's mainly sort of a scientist group, and of capital. They have got capital backing as well. But a long time ago, there was a chap there called Chris Foster, who was working at AEG on the coal switch, and he set up this other thing, and we've ended up with these shares that we've inherited. So yeah, you are completely right. You could do the math with our holding. It's all there in the open. It's 3.5 to 4 million pounds worth of value in an unlisted company. We've got the coal switch patents, we've got the licenses for it. There is all value there, and obviously we've got treasury money, we've got money in our bank account, and any money that we have got has been spent on infrastructure in the ground in the UAE. So yeah, I mean, we certainly are undervalued if you're asking that question, Kevin.
Tell me a little bit more about coal switch. What does it do so people can understand?
It's basically a coal replacement. It's derived from waste wood. And if you were to liken it to anything, it's like putting AdBlue into your diesel car. it takes out a certain amount of carbon emission. And what it was designed for was to go in alongside coal power stations to help reduce that carbon emission.
Okay, so it is a product on the market that's being used?
Unfortunately, not at the moment. We own all the IP. As Paul indicated before, previous board took some wrong decisions, let's say, and never quite developed it out to a commercial product. What they did do, they proved concept. They proved the product actually works. And I can't say too much because it's not been disclosed, but we are in the background working with a number of the old advisors to reignite it. But I think the focus...
That was a pun, Adrian. That was a pun. Reignite it. Stolen jokes. Like
a few puns in the air. But
I think, Kevin, as well, if you actually read up on it...
On cash.
If you read up on it, Kevin, you will see that it does tick all the boxes. And, you know, it is something that is really clever and, you know, it needs to be done. You know, it burns hotter than coal. It's cheaper. It's more sustainable. And as Adrian pointed out, it ticks all the boxes on carbon footprint, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, it's there and it's still in the background, burning away, as it were.
So Alpha Prospects, I presume, holds many more things than Coal Switch.
They don't own...
Like an incubator. If you were to liken it, it's an incubator of really clever clean tech. And as all these businesses are, it just takes one to catch on, and it'll be significant.
So, but Coal we just put it in the back. Coal Switch is part of Alpha Prospects.
No,
you own the paint.
No. Coal Switch is purely AEG's. Nothing to do with anyone else.
Okay, very good. Now, we looked, when you originally talked about what you were going to be doing, you're obviously infrastructure of the digital, but you also talked about solar rooftops. So just tell us a little bit about what your plans are for the solar rooftop business. And yeah, it's a bit maybe less exciting than some of the others, but it could produce some nice income. So tell us a little bit more.
When we looked at recapitalizing the business and putting a strategy together, we realized that deploying cash into a proprietary technology isn't always a sensible move. We need cash in the business. Solar, it's like vanilla. It's a very easy business model to follow. We have access to about 30 megawatt of rooftop space. And what we call rooftop space is above large warehouses or large buildings where it's an owner-tenant environment. They want to place solar on the roof to generate low-cost electricity, but also it helps with their ESG, certainly if it's large corporate organizations. And what we do, we've got to build out from somewhere between £100,000 to £250,000. We then deploy a number of them, repackage them, refinance them, and our return on investment is anywhere between 7 and 9 years. But they generate cash for the next 25 years. So it will be a long-term cash-generating business. If you were to put it into that matrix, this would be like your cash cow in the long run. It would just continually generate cash with very little oversight.
It's a pretty safe one, Kevin. It's also index-linked as well. You know, it ticks all the boxes for your bankers, etc. It's just slow, steady growth.
And which country or where are you specific
all
about
in
where
UK.
It's going to be? The UK?
All in the UK.
Do we have enough sun in the UK?
We have enough of these, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to ask that, actually, because you obviously the 300 megawatt is your sort of longer-term goal in the UAE, and you talked about 1 gigawatt globally. Have you identified any other countries other than the UK and UAE where you could potentially roll this out?
I think we're at the start of a journey, and I'm a great believer because I've seen businesses before where they suddenly get too big too quickly. I'm a great believer of let's do something and let's do it really well. And once we've done it really well, we can then step out of our comfort zone. And more importantly, we can fund our own development. So if we do make a mistake, okay, we've made a mistake, we can step back again. But at the end of the day, 300 megawatt in the UAE is a sizable business. And, you know, from our shareholders' point of view, that will be a really good return on their investment. And more importantly, we can deliver that in a short space of time. So within 36 months, we could be at that stage. And I think that's not a bad business from being 12 months ago where the business was literally bankrupt.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be absolutely incredible. You'd have $125 million if it carries a free cash flow per annum from that business alone. Maybe you have some solar. Maybe, you know, as you say, Coleswitch can be operated or spun out in some way, which you guys are going to get a benefit from. We haven't really talked about the treasury, but it's not really a big part of it right now. And you've got the Alpha Prospect stock. I mean, basically, if you achieve what you're telling us, 300 megawatts within 3 years, this is a £1 billion company.
Kevin, I'm a realist in the sense that if we deliver 100 megawatt in the next 12 months, I think we'll be a business that has done extremely well on a market that is not seeing a lot of growth. So we will be a darling just in aim if we can deliver that megawatt at those cash streams.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I can see that there's massive potential. So I'm coming back to you, Paul. What do you see as the catalyst going forward in terms of the business? How do you see people are going to realize, you know, your potential?
Well, I think first of all is the delivery on the first 8 megawatt, and as Adrian pointed out, that's proof of concept, cash generating in January. That is the big thing. And an easy rollout. It's not like doing something in the UK where you've got to get your planning and you've got to, you know, wait for everything else to be in a line. It's a lot easier in the UAE. There's a lot, obviously, you've got all your permits, etc., and everything, but they're more friendly to people that are trying to grow in the UAE rather than over here in the UK where you are held back a little bit with the red tape, which we all know. So I think that's going to be our first catalyst on where we're going to be going, and that's going to be the easiest and quickest one, because how many other businesses can you say within, you know, quite rightly within 12 months or so we could literally be up 100 megawatts?
Yeah, I'm a bit flabbergasted, to be honest. I think the market's missed this one completely, but let's hope that as we start to discuss and move forward with the stuff that we've started to discuss now, people are going to see the potential. I mean, even the 8 megawatts, $3.5 million of revenue, annual revenue, $1.75 million of free cash flow, you know, you're going to be worth significantly more than you are now, especially when the vast majority of the market cap now is covered by this Alpha Prospects. And then Coleswitch is a bit of a shot in the dark, isn't it? If it works, you know, it could ignite the share price, pun intended.
Exactly. But also, Kevin, and you pointed out again with Alpha Prospects, it only needs for one of their little concepts to happen, then again, you're on another level.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I can see it. Hopefully.
And that we just consider as being a bonus that's always there in the background.
Yeah. Okay. So we always ask the slightly difficult question, which is, what could go wrong? So as you're the realist, Adrian, tell me what could go wrong.
I think the real exposure with the UAE, price can go up, data centers, the need for data centers, or more importantly, the capacity suddenly increases and the price drops. But I think we've covered that, Kevin, in the fact that we've already got ultra low cost power, we're modular driven, and we've cut our sort of cost of operating to its bare minimum. So if we can generate cash quickly over the next 12, 18 months, and have all our return on capital back, then we're in it theoretically at net cost. And then even if there is a price correction, then we're still ahead of the game.
Yeah, the statement you're looking for is you'll be in it to win it by that stage, because you'll be on a free ride, which is obviously exactly what we want to be in.
Absolutely, Kevin. I think you're absolutely right. This is a fast-moving sector. We don't know what's around the corner, but We're built for speed. The fact that we don't have a heavy burden on operational cost, we are partner driven. So as we scale, they scale. And if we have to slightly retract, we do. But we're not taking that cost with us.
I do think, guys, though, as well, if you look at the fact that obviously myself, Adrian, you, Kevin, we're all at a certain age, but we're all using AI now. Whereas if you go back generationally, when, you know, the people in their 50s and 60s, they wouldn't be touching the internet to start. But now it's so easy to use for everyone. I do just think that, you know, you've got, it's just so much more mainstream now. Everyone's doing everything on the chatbots and with AI. So the data centers, I don't think there is going to be anyone, there is going to be a continual growth there, 100%, I believe.
Well, that's the hard question out of the way, as Kev said, and onto something slightly harder. What is, I mean, you're on the Sunday roast. What is the perfect Sunday roast in the Elliott household? I guess we'll start with you, Paul.
I'm a traditionalist. It's got to be beef, but rare beef.
Nice.
You actually caught me out with that question, I'll be honest with you.
So, Paul, we have to ask you, because you are a Southern softie born, have you been manipulated to the gravy, or are you still dry as a bone?
I am definitely a gravy man, but I don't like it too thick, which is my southern side, I think, isn't it?
And what about the horseradish? Are we talking creamed horseradish, so it's just a nice taste, or you want your head blown off?
I'd like my horseradish hot, yes, definitely.
Yes, good.
Oh dear, that's not my idea.
Adrian, okay, Adrian. Proper northerner.
We're northerners, so we like plenty of gravy, plenty of horseradish, and beef with Yorkshire pudding. But what I was going to say, I do have a little website called Best Sunday Roast.
Oh, brilliant.
Wow.
So I lived in London. I couldn't find a decent Sunday roast. So I put a little website up saying Best Sunday Roast.
Go on then, share as you are, and we'll put that in the description. And if anyone's hunting out, presumably you've updated that, or you keep it live?
Yeah, it's taken a bit of a back burner because of... I fly in and out of the UAE a lot. So, yeah, we need to reinvigorate it and probably do Sunday roast out in the UAE. So,
yeah.
The next move. Yeah, so it's bestsundayroast.com.
I'll tell you, turn it into Benidorm, you boys. I think it's a bad idea there.
We need to put the link to this podcast on your Best Sunday Roast then, for sure. And then you're going to have people listening to what you really do. But that's very good. The other question that Phil normally asks is, go for your other question, Phil, like the best.
Yeah, I mean, what starting with you, Adrian, what's the best advice you've ever received or heard?
Probably my father. If you want to be a certain person, you need to create your environment and mix with that environment. So if you want to be successful, hang around with successful people.
Cool.
Loyalty. That's the best thing for me. And Adrian and I are friends for 35 years. We've got a very small group of friends, and I believe in loyalty. That's the best advice I've ever received.
That's good.
Good. Okay, guys. Well, I think you're on to a win as long as you execute. I think you're going to be rich. In terms of what percentage of the companies do you guys own, how much are you in the game for this?
Well, basically, I've got a small shareholding as a director at the moment, but I've also got a convertible loan note where I can go up to 29.9% of the company, which, again, I wouldn't be doing that now because it wouldn't be good for the shareholders that are in there now. But yes, I'm literally in it for a fair amount of money. Yes, we've invested a lot.
You're in it to win it.
Hope so.
To win it.
And Adrian,
and they put me on performance bonus, so I've got to perform in order to get my bonus.
You have indeed.
And well, after negotiating with them to come on the roast, I understand that must have been quite a negotiation, Adrian.
I think the main thing here is under promise, over deliver, and I think that's been our motto from the start.
Brilliant. Okay, on that note, we'll say Paul Elliott and Adrian Gleave of Active Energy Group, thanks very much for appearing on the roast.
Thanks, Phil, and thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, guys.
Let's move on to our second guest this week. We're joined by Colin Bird, seasoned mining engineer and veteran of the industry with over 40 years of experience. Welcome back to the roast, Colin. How's life?
Well, thank you for being invited back. And life is pretty, well, it's hectic, isn't it, for all of us, I guess. Quite a lot. That's an understatement. There's a lot going off, and positive all round. And we've got to really get in there and make things happen so we can enjoy the benefits, which I think those benefits are enduring. It's, you know, what we're seeing in the copper price. Fundamentally, we're talking there about something with real legs and fundamentals, supply and demand. And we all know that the demand side is not challenged at all. The demand is increasing. But we do know that the supply side is totally wrecked and there's no new mines on the horizon. And then, of course, when one talks about the precious metals, in particularly in terms of what we're doing, byproducts, supply-demand fundamentals, I guess, are into silver more than gold. But I can't see it any day now where geopolitical tensions are going to subside. New ones arrive. The tariff conundrums are with us all the time. So one of our commodities, our copper, we've got a tsunami approaching, I think, between supply and demand. And copper, gold, there's enough geopolitical stuff going on, I think, to maintain that. And, you know, I talked about one of our projects, in actual fact, since August, going up about 35-40%. Just on the change in gold, silver, and copper. So when your revenue goes up like that and your costs are not necessarily going up anywhere near like that, it's happy days for our shareholders.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, as you just said there, you know, copper's trading well above that sort of almost psychological mark of 10,000. It's around the 11,000 as of mid-October. And that's obviously pushing a lot of previously less viable mines back into what could be economic territory now, especially those that were struggling around that sort of 9,000 per ton mark. So, you know, looking ahead over the next year to 5 years, the outlook's looking pretty strong for copper. Obviously, as you just said, ongoing demand from the energy transition, you know, I think electric vehicles and renewable infrastructure, copper is likely to stay in high demand. So just give us your outlook for copper in the next 12 to 24 months.
Yeah, thank you for that, Phil. I wouldn't put too much store on mines being brought back into production, because you know what our industry is like, you guys do, that any mines which have been in production, they've hung on in the 7,000s. I can't offhand think of a developed mine which in actual fact say, right, we'll turn that back on. Panama might come on, of course, but that's for political reasons, you know, the First Quantum one. But I can't see that the supply-demand fundamentals will be affected by old mines which have been mothballed suddenly being brought into production. I did see yesterday or the day before, I think it was, that BHP are talking about revisiting all of their projects in the USA against the new fundamentals created by tariffs and all of that. But, you know, revisiting your mines with a company like BHP to bring one into production was probably 10 to 15 years. So your stated time horizon in the next two would certainly not be affected. The tariffs will have short-term effect for better or for worse. But I think if you look at the demand slowly increasing, and I'm not putting too much dependence on electric cars, that's not without problems and rollout problems. But the sheer demand of the third world developing countries, the need for, you know, more disposable income, the need for cars, telephones, and all of the things what goes with increased material wealth are all going to trigger this copper. And I keep using the word tsunami. And
It is.
And I'm amazed at the supply side. It's the half-hearted attempts to basically do something about it. You know, the Tech Anglo merger, what did that do? Again, copper out of one pocket into another. You know, they can merge as long as they like, but they're not creating new copper. And Phil, I just don't see that new copper in the size that is required. I just don't see it even on the drawing board at the moment, let alone the horizon. So I think the next basically 2 years, you will see attempts to push it down, because there are countries which have got an interest in the copper price not running away. So there'll be attempts to push it down. But I think there's a tsunami, and you can't push a tsunami back. So the copper price is going to, in my opinion, is, I don't want to, you know, I'm starting to see that $13,000 to $15,000 again, $1,000. That scares me. I don't really, we don't need to be there. And I don't even think it's good for the world to be there. I see a steady state 10.5 plus. And you might think me that, you might say, well, that's a bit pessimistic for somebody who's got his feet right in the gold and will bet it be by 15,000. But one of the most dangerous things you can do if you're in my position is to start believing that sort of, you know, if it happens, it happens. It just all goes to the bottom line. But when you've got a mine which breaks even at 7.5, probably a bit less, copper, you can feel quite comfortable when you see the sort of things which are happening and are projected to happen over the next 2 years.
Absolutely.
So 2 years, I'm 10.5 to answer the question, 10,500 steady state will do me.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm predicting. You may see a spike of 12, you may see another short trough, and it will be a short trough of 8.8, so be it. But I think steady state 10.5 plus is where I'd like to be and expect to be.
And one of your ex-posts, Colin, recently, where you said that whilst copper is on a roll, silver and gold are reaching all-time highs, and Bezant Resources' project in Namibia include both gold and silver, and the way the two precious metals are going soon be questionable whether it's a copper mine or a gold mine, all fighting for pole position. So, yeah, I mean, we've obviously talked about that in past, you know, the Hope and Goran project, but just give us your thoughts on whether it really is a copper mine or a gold mine.
It's about, at the moment, it's 50-50-ish. And, but I mean, I actually look at it more simplistic than that, on the basis that the gold and silver can pay all the operating costs and the copper's on a free ride, or vice versa. The copper pay all the operating costs and whatever we get from gold and silver is on a free ride. So, plus the profits and the margins, of course, you get from your copper. So to have a basket, what I really like is a basket of metals, all of which are on a roll, with not a lot of interdependency. Copper is responding to pure industrial fundamentals, whereas gold and silver are responding to a geopolitical uncertainties and you know, as the alternative store for the alternative currency. So there's not dependent fundamentals, and each one has got its own legs. And that makes for a very strong basket.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the general idea is that copper is a base metal and gold is a precious metal, right? So if there's a recession going on in the world, then copper is meant to go down in price and gold is meant to go up. And vice versa, if there's a load of growth, people are investing. So they don't really want to have gold. They want to be investing in companies. They want to be investing in growth. So copper should become more expensive because there's more demand for it. And gold should go down. But that's just not happening anymore. Gold is going to record highs. Copper is very strong. What do you think, Colin? Is it the debasement trade? Is it just the US dollar becoming less valuable, so everything's just being pushed up? Is it the increased demand for copper, the increased demand we've got, you know, from like AI data centers or EVs? Or is it just the fundamental repricing of the supply gap that we've been waiting for the past few years?
It's all of those. Plus, it's paydays come, you know. I said this in 2006. You know, I think people probably got very short memories, but, you know, in 2006, I was preaching, oh dear, this is payback time. Now you're seeing these metals come forward and you're seeing a tremendous investment in exploration. It's payback because we've underinvested in the search for these commodities and these metals. Then came 2008 and it wrecked all of that. And, you know, Charles, it never came back. Then it came 2021 and that, the small industry, the prospectors, the future of these metals, basically had 5 or 6 years in the wilderness. So you've got a collection of total underinvestment in finding new supplies. You've got chief executives of major companies who are driven by dividends. And I was always taught, if you think you act 6 monthly, then you start thinking 6 monthly.
Yeah.
And CEOs of the major outfits must be thinking 50 years ahead. And I'm afraid, you know, the world is going to pay dearly over the next few years for underinvestment in the global resource industry. And so it's a collection of all those things. And I think I do see a correction in the major stock markets, you know, for the major companies. But I really don't think that will affect us, because the surge for basics, you know, when we're talking copper, we're talking about basic materials. The surge in demand. The surge in demand, I don't think, will be stopped. It may be slowed, Charles. That's why I'd sooner back 10,500 than 15,000. It may be slowed, but nonetheless, that trend upwards will continue, and the supply will stay where it is now, or even drop off a little bit with some of the negative political aspects which are coming out of Latin America. You know, it's where a lot of the big mines are. And it's where a lot of this sort of political unrest is. So I'm not even worried about a recession, depression, call it what you like. Obviously, demand is going to drop, but the actual curve is going to be going upwards and the progressing upwards. And the supply side will remain raked. I keep quoting that. I probably never miss the opportunity on a podcast. If you're going to build a big copper mine, you need 10 to 15 years. And Phil and I were talking about the next 2 years. I think you can comfortably talk about the next 5 years being a sort of a very, very difficult period for people who are wanting copper. And you're seeing it now, you know, the end users are going straight to the market, you know, and going past the traders. So when you start seeing that, you see that the end user is more worried about will he have his metal than what the cost of the metal is going to be. And that to secure one of his major cost items, the price, is a sensible thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then you're seeing a lot of, particularly coming from India, you're seeing offset programs where they're investing in the copper industries. But all the money is going to the majors, and it's just beginning to trickle down now to we juniors. And I don't know, you know, I never like the expression juniors, but to the emerging mining companies, the money is beginning to trickle down us. The sort of approaches we're getting are different than they've ever been in my career.
You're starting to notice it, aren't you? Yeah, 100%.
It's changing, but it's fundamentals will change. But I think that the surge, particularly for copper, is basically unstoppable.
Well, I think if you have this massive supply gap, and we've been warned about it for the past 4 or 5 years already, you know, and now you're starting to see it come through. But actually, as you say, if you want to build a big mine 10 to 15 years, or do you want to build 20 or 30 smaller mines and get them up and running, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years or even sooner in some cases, it's kind of, it's almost like they don't have a choice. And the majors, you know, I think one of my bugbears with them over the past 2 or even 3 decades is their exploration spend has just got smaller and smaller and smaller. And so they're in a position where they probably want to develop new major mines, but there aren't any because they haven't spent any money looking for them. So you know, basically they're caught between a rock and a hard place now, aren't they? Is what it feels like over the medium term anyway.
Summed up in one, an absolute perfect summary, because it's no good, like you say, they're wishing, but wishing doesn't help too much. The reality is the money hasn't been spent. And as I said earlier, I think that more is echoing my words that the payday is going to come for a lack of investment in exploration over the last 25 years, plus the period between 2008, that's another 16, last 40 years. That's an awful long time, Charles, for not to be doing what you should be doing as major mining companies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the new business department now consists of a bunch of guys whamming computers and probably two or three geologists. And then they're going out for the discoveries, and there haven't been any real big discoveries. So merging between one another is not going to help. It doesn't create new copper. Right. And they basically face the fundamentals in their drive for dividends. They've lost sight of the fact that quality earnings means you can replace the copper. And in 10 or 15 years time, you're still producing as much. And if our demand cycle is, that we project is right, not only have you got to be producing as much copper, you've got to be producing significantly more copper. And Charles, I just don't see that. And then you make the comment about we need 20 small mines. Several of the major mining companies now are adopting a small mines policy, where if you'd have mentioned it to them a year ago or 2 years, they'd have run a mile. But the majors are realizing they can't develop the mines in time, so we'd better now start getting involved with smaller production, which is closer to production, and let's get involved in those sort of projects. And it's happening, and you know, people are seeing the approaches in our sector.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because exploration is expensive, but then compared to the market caps of these companies, maybe not so much, you know. And if you look at like the Rio Tintos or the Glencores of the world, and they're paying, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 or even higher percentage dividends every year, if they just took, you know, a very small amount of that dividend they're paying out and put it into exploration, whether by themselves or, you know, joint ventures with Virginias, they'd probably be in a much better position to pay those dividends out sustainably over the next couple of decades. The problem that they might have going forward is, having not spent any money on exploration, they have to pay through the nose for whatever discoveries are made, you know, or have already been made. Or alternatively, they're going to have to put a hell of a lot more money than they want to into exploration over the next, you know, 3 to 4 years.
Well, then that's right. But, you know, you're fighting something which has left you, Charles. That's the problem. Yeah. It's left you. I mean, you use the word wish, and there must be a lot of chief executives wishing and boards wishing they'd spent money over the last 10 or 15 years. So they'd be in bold position. But wishing is not going to help very much. The juniors, you know, haven't found many new big ore bodies. Lots of little ore bodies are being approached now. And because of ore sorting and things like that, have brought themselves into play. But, you know, you're probably one of the best analysts, if not the best analysts I've ever come across. And I don't say that lightly, Charles. I say it very, very sincerely. And I would suggest that you visit, go back 50 years, 70 years.
Yeah.
And it's probably a difficult analysis to do, but probably somebody's done it already. But The majors, when they did explore, Charles, they didn't find ore bodies. That's why most of them cut their exploration departments down to zero or near zero, because they were not very successful in finding mines. Then they went the joint venture route. That didn't work out too well, really. Of course, the juniors weren't finding them. Then they sort of stepped to one side and wait for the quality discoveries, which didn't happen. And, you know, really, let's use one of my old companies as an example, who found the Sentinel mine in Zambia, and we sold it for $265 million, and it took us 19 months to do it. I don't think, and that was 2009, 2010, I don't think this AIM has had a discovery like that, have they, for 15 years?
No.
But a discovery which was brought into production, and there's been lots of talks about big ore bodies, but a discovery what was brought into production. So, you know, that's a long gap, and that's a single project in a market in 15 years. Take that global to Toronto, Australia. There's been probably more discoveries in those jurisdictions. But we're desperately short of new copper capacity. I think that sums it all up. We're desperately short of new capacity, and the demand ain't going to stop.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because we're desperately short, but the answer is, and you know, you see, forgive the French, if you see companies pissing about with radar surveys and, you know, surface stuff and whatever, and it's all well and good, but actually what you need is drilling. You need meters in the ground globally. And then you'll find the stuff. When the copper is there to be found, it might be harder to find it because the easy fruit's been picked, but it is there to be found. You just need to drill for it. And I feel like globally, whether it's the majors or the juniors, there's lack of an understanding. That's actually the only way. I don't think any major discovery has ever been made without a drill bit, right?
That's right, Charles. I mean, you know, you can wish as much as you like. We used that wish a few times. I mean, take our little group of companies. We've done 9 drill programs and 50,000 meters in 4 years. Charles, that's more than some majors.
Yeah.
And that's more than some majors. And what does Donald say? Drill, baby, drill. And, you know, I'm sorry for once I'm on his side. Drill, baby, drill. And you're absolutely right. Wishing we'd got more copper isn't much use. You've got to go out and find it.
Well, in the case of Bazam, for example, Hoping Gorup, that's what a smaller mine potentially looking at financing shortly. And I'm not going to ask you to make a forward-looking statement because I know you don't want to and you would never do that. However, you know, just in terms of you're looking at, you know, that huge strike length you have that's completely, you know, completely not explored at all. You think in a world where copper was desired and we know that there's copper there to be found, that somebody would want to come in and fund the exploration of that project, you know, while you're also developing it, you know, to sell the copper that you already have. Would you not?
Well, I don't want to try and appear clever, but when I go back through our career, really, and the rules were quite, you know, they sort of, modus operandi were quite consistent over countries and commodities. Go where the majors have been and gone, because often they didn't leave for the right reasons. By doing that, you collect a huge database, which would take 5 years to generate and probably $25 million. Go where there's an opportunity to develop a mine, but make sure that your story isn't finite and it is open-ended. And you know, Byzant Open Gorup really fits that model. There's a mine that we're ready to start. Let's call it phase one, about 8,000 tons of copper per year. Phase two will consist of a much bigger mine, which we're aiming to be 20 to 25,000 tons of copper per year. That will be our target. And to make that target, believable, investable, if you like, is a better word, I think, is that you need 500,000 tons. 25 years at 20,000 tons is 500,000 tons of contained copper. Well, if you look 17 kilometers between Open Gorup and more beyond Open Gorup, which has got anomalies and good evidence of copper, and that's the perfect situation. And you're absolutely right, Charles. But when you're looking at Byzant and when you're looking at the Open Gorup in particular, You've got the short term answer to producing some new copper at very nice prices for the material, for the commodity, and then you're also looking at 17 kilometers of strike, which can generate, we're targeting, not less than 500,000 tons of contained copper. So that applies to a lot of our projects, and quite a few of our projects as well, where you've got immediate production potential and in association with large concessions of copper where copper has been found before. Not a concept, Charles. Copper has been found before. Over that 17 kilometres, there's been 69,000 metres of drilling. So a lot of the work we will be doing will be definition and confirmatory. And the word exploration is redundant because it's been found. So the answer is yes. What a nice situation to be in with the open Gorup.
Well, across the stable, isn't it? Because obviously Afton Pioneer with Ongombo, similar situation.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and then Extract with Silver King, that, you know, the grades coming out there were looking fantastic. And then even, you know, Galileo with Luan Sobe. So you have multiple projects across the portfolio where all of the work has been done. And now we're just effectively in this kind of, I don't want to call it a perfect storm, because maybe it's not perfect. We're in a very nice storm where the demand for copper is there. And now, you know, you don't have to walk up and ask for financing. The financiers are coming to you because they're looking at the attractiveness of what you have in the portfolio. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I would say, and I don't want to be arrogant in saying it, but we started the mission in 2017. We saw it come in. I have to say that I've been surprised it's been taken so long for Wake Up to come. I am totally amazed that Wake Up hasn't totally come yet. You're still fighting for every penny you get into your companies. And I just can't believe it took Donald to wake up. I mean, these Senate committees, you know, on strategic metals, they were started in 2010, 2008, and they've done nothing.
It's the stockpiling, right, more than anything else, that they're now starting to stockpile. But they've chosen to start stockpiling when metal prices are, you know, multi-decade highs, and sold off all their stockpiles when the metal prices were super cheap. You kind of, you know, the metals don't go off. You know, they're not like, you know, a loaf of bread. It just, there seems to be no logic behind it, behind any of the sector, is what it feels like to me as an outsider looking in. I mean, what do you think?
I'm totally confounded. I'm totally confused. I see lots of people jumping up and down, making lots of noise. I've seen it for the last 3 years, but I've seen zero action. I've seen the junior sector fight for money when he should have been the darling of the city 3 or 4 years ago in anticipation of this. So a lot of what's happening in the world, I think, you know, confounds a logical person. They can't just understand. You don't really need 4 years at Harvard to you know, the debate we've been having. You don't need to an MBA for the
we don't
replace as fast as you take out, Charles. You're in trouble. But when you're actually using much faster than you're producing, you would have thought these analysts and these CEOs of these major companies would have set the stall out, and in actual fact would want to be front runner in their inventory. And I think companies, you know, the major mining companies, they should be valuing them now on their copper inventory, not their copper production.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because if you look at, you know, not just your portfolio, but just in general, if you look like the continent of Africa, I'm thinking about more and more. If you look at Zambia or Botswana or Namibia, there's almost certainly major discoveries out there, you know, tier one discoveries ready to be drilled and found, right? And the sooner, it's almost, it's kind of like, it's really funny. It's this mentality that the majors have, which is, we don't want to invest the money now because we might not find it. And then even if we do find it, it'll be 10, 15 years before we get it online. Well, you'll be, you know, in 10 or 15 years, that time is going to pass anyway. So surely you want to start getting ahead of it, even if you've left it very late. But and yet they don't seem to want, like, why is the exploration spend not increasing massively now?
Well, I think there is the realization they just, the boat's left, you know, and they missed that boat. And they see they only hope now, and that's why you've seen the mergers. The easiest way to get out of that mess is to go and buy, you know, doing a merger like Teck and Anglo. That's why BHP went after Anglo. So that's so short term. That's just keeping the dividend going, keeping the growth story going. Wanted the biggest on the block. And we saw it with the banks, and now we've seen it. We've also seen it with the mining companies, too big to fail. And that's not the case. So we're talking about a train what's left the station. The only redress, quite frankly, is the available mines, and they would go some way towards a redress. But like you say, there's a need now for even government-sponsored, but the major attack on finding new metals, new mines, and of course, what comes into the story is regulations, like it did with the banks. You've got to re-examine your regulatory, environmental, and permissioning, and you've really got to basically streamline and fast-track the business. But the world is in a mess for metals. I gave a presentation in London, I think it was 2 years ago, March, And
I was there, I remember.
What was the opening slide? We fought wars over oil, we might fight wars over copper.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
I was a little bit tongue-in-cheek then. I was a bit tongue-in-cheek, Charlie, but Charles, but if I was to say it now, I wouldn't be tongue-in-cheek.
No. Well, this is the funny thing, right? Because a couple of years ago, when I was in that room with you, but just in general, talking about gold, tungsten, copper, silver, and I was saying these things are going to go up massively over the next 2 or 3 years. No one was paying attention. Nobody cared at all. But now that we're at record pricing, suddenly everyone wants to jump into the trade, which always seems to be the way, doesn't it?
Yeah, but my problem is it was so obvious.
Yeah, it was.
I don't feel I was particularly smart. I don't feel I was particularly predictive or analytical. I just thought that there was an obvious rising need. And I didn't even put it on electric cars. I just thought this sort of the emergence of several wealthy economies getting wealthier, and therefore material demands rising of the population. I thought it was as simple as that.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Global growth, Charles, was going to drive copper. And everybody talked about electric vehicles. Electric vehicles stalled last year, so everybody jumped on copper and said copper's finished. Nonsense. Yes, electric vehicles stalled and will stall further. But the driving forces are out there are massive, massive.
Yeah, they're all third world things, Colin. I mean, we've literally got millions of apartments going up all around us here in Cairo. People need fridges, microwaves, ovens, and all of these things need huge amounts of copper. India is a good example. We've literally got 100 to 200 million becoming closer to middle class. Want a fridge, want a not necessarily electric one.
A car will do.
All of the things, which is going to create the demand for copper, which we don't have enough of. It's as simple as that. Now, one question I've got that's burning in my head that we got a lot of stick for a number of years ago. You've got 1.3 million tons of contained copper in Bus Ranger in Australia in extract. Surely over the next period of time, that's going to become more than viable.
That has to be a true statement. If what I've been ranting on about for the last half hour is true, then the search for projects, what could be brought on stream pretty quickly, is going to accelerate, we've all said. And 1.3 million tons of copper open-ended has to fall into the next generation of copper projects around the world of sufficient size to interest the majors in a very, very sort of acceptable jurisdiction, Australia. So the answer to that has to be yes. Why don't they see it? Why don't they come after it? The capital, but again, you're not going to build. You're not going to build that operation in 2 years. You're going to be on a 6-year build. And, by the time you've finished, you've got your permitting as well in New South Wales. Then you've got your build. So the answer to that has to be an obvious yes. Why on earth isn't the industry attracted to it? Will they be attracted to it? Yes. And how long will it take? Is something I can't really answer. But it seems to be the logical progression of the discussion, doesn't it? That projects like that who just sort of didn't quite make it on a viability break basis must start now coming into the picture.
But going back to Namibia, I mean, basically, you're going to have Hukongorup, you're going to have Ongombo, and the extension of both of those. Between them, they're going to be worth over 1 million contained tons of copper, more than likely. I know you can't say that categorically, but it's not 1 million miles away, and it will not be 1 million miles away when all's said and done.
No, that's right. And there's plants available and there's processing capacity available. Some of the, in fact, everything we've got there really, there's entries into these prospects, quite a large percentage of open pitable material. So to be brought on stream and address some of this problem probably would be a lot quicker in both African Pioneer and be a lot quicker than real greenfield projects, which now are going into the next phase. These are mine ready, not drill ready. These are mine ready now, where the studying is about what size plant we're putting in, how does the mine look, what's the capital cost of the mine, and what's the infrastructure around it. And so they're real brownfields and would not take much more than 5 years to bring into production to be up to that sort of rate that you're talking about of you know, in terms of total to contain tons, and 20, 25 years, it's quite large annual tonnages. So yes, Namibia is in pole position for these for the investment and to help meet some of the demand.
And Colin, just a more specific question on Hoogenborp and Bazan. Just explain to the listeners about the gold credit. Currently is about 0.29 or 0.3 grams per ton. But when it was being drilled, they didn't bother assaying the gold on a lot of it. So just tell us, you know, what I know you can't really say what your expectations
are. Well, I mean, really, it's 0.6, Kevin. That's what we'll be pulling. And we'll have about 6 to 7 grams in concentrate. And that's been tested. I think I wouldn't have announced it had I not have sort of been in an RNS. So the gold and silver is the only reason it's not totally in resource is the fact that just wind the clock back to the 70s when a company like Gold Fields were there doing the drilling. They were mining mines in South Africa at 12 and 15 grams. Tell the company chairman that you're very pleased with yourself, you find 0.6 grams, he would laugh at you of gold. He would laugh at you. They'd not got the capability to even test for it, nor did they bother, because they were sent there by the bosses, you know, in the 1970s to find a new Zambian copper belt. So the fact that you got a bit of incidental copper and a bit of incidental silver was of zilch interest. And I don't think they dared have told that, you know, say to the boss, they would have said to the boss, there's a bit of gold there, and he would have raised his arm and say, so what? You know, what's the copper?
And what about the silver? I mean, we'd never really even talked about it. I just looked at gold and copper.
We could have about 50 grams of silver in concentrate. And, you know, that's got on towards 2 ounces. And, you know, you turn the clock back, you wouldn't be paid for silver and gold. But now payabilities are something like the knock off a gram off and pay you 90%, or the knock a gram off and pay you 94%. And similar with silver, they discard a bit and then pay you 90% of the contained value. So the concentrate addition of base precious metals to the final concentrate is extremely significant.
Well, right now on $50 silver, which is actually a farce because you can't buy it for less than $70 at the minute, is over $100 per ton to be added to the calculations.
So that's a percent of copper, isn't it?
Yep.
Looking at it simply, it's a percent of copper.
Yeah, I'm going to get
so if you're looking at, you've got 1.3, that's 2.3% copper equivalent, that order.
Yes,
so when I say, when I say that you're getting close to, is it a copper mine or is it a precious metal mine? The figures users come up with more or less certify the statement.
So, Charles, I think you really need to redo your figures on Bazan, because at 0.6, 50 grams of silver, even at the current copper prices, the numbers are bananas.
Well, they're not too shabby, are they? I mean, the question is, all of this huge profit, I mean, you're looking at sort of 45 million in net revenue. But you know, per year from the open pit alone, based on the current gold, you know, gold and copper prices, that's without taking into account, you know, silver credits or the additional gold that's being reported. But that all hinges on getting financing to build this mine. And as we said before, something around, and I know, Colin, you can't comment, so I'm not sure, I will say it for you, something around the $15 million mark to get cracking now. Surely with the economics as they are, that should be coming around shortly.
Well, you would say that, wouldn't you?
Don't say a word, Colin. Don't say a word.
Well, I'm Manly Rice Davis at the moment.
Indeed. And then once, I do feel as well that once you get Hoogangoro back and running and sorted, then that validates the rest of the portfolio, and then African Pioneer will get cracking, and so will Extract, and so will Galileo. But it's wonderful to talk to you, Colin. It's wonderful to hear you. You know what? I think it's wonderful because it's very easy for us to sit there in 2022 and 2023 and 2024 saying everything is going to be all right and everything will be fine, everything will go up. But it's not easy to go through it. Now we're in 2025, everyone's in much higher spirits, and everyone, it seems a lot easier to be sitting on these assets than maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, and of course, it's the final push of the stone, if you know what I mean. And we've got all hands to the deck. We're doing it in an environment we couldn't, you know, our most sort of...
In your wildest dreams.
We've got now. So it's never easy Charles, but I tell you what, it's a better environment when it was 2 years ago. I'll say that as a minimum optimism, and it's a much better environment to be working in. And the cards now that we've got are a damn sight stronger than they were 3 years ago, 2 years ago. And we're looking forward to bringing this mine into production. And as you say, and I rather hope there are other companies on it and manage to bring projects into production too. Because if anything, our shareholders, the market, the AIM market, the junior sector needs, it needs success, it needs the credibility of production, and it needs the credibility of forecast being met, both in terms of quantum, grade, and forget revenue, we don't handle the revenue, but you know, in terms of against revenue, margins achieved, and profits achieved. So I think that whether it's Byzant, and I'm doing my level best to make sure Byzant is the front runner on AIM, but whether it's Byzant or someone else, the market really needs that success. The shareholders deserve the success. They've been long suffering. And I'm doing my best to make sure Byzant is the front runner in delivering that success to the market and to its shareholders who have basically supported the company for a long time. It's often thought we don't appreciate that, Charles. We do appreciate it, and we know what it's like to put money into a project and wish you knew more what was going on. But understand that the company is unable to share everything with you. Our supporters, our shareholders and supporters have been very, very loyal, and we thank them for it. And I'm doing my level best together with the team, and we've got a nice team. We've got a good team. And I'm doing my level best to make sure we deliver both to the AIM market, to the UK market, and in particular to our shareholders. Wonderful. That's my only one goal at the moment. I'm so focused on bringing this into production that you wouldn't believe it.
Sounds promising, Colin, and we thank you for appearing back on the roast. So Colin Bird, thanks very much for your time again.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me, and let's look forward to the next few months.
Thanks, Colin.
Cheers, Colin.
Thank you.
So okay, let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. Eco Buildings, they're up some 150%, Kev. Just give us a sort of review of why you think they're suddenly up. Because obviously there was news about the Serbia, there was news about rollout in different regions. Just give us a sort of big summary on where we are with the Eco Buildings.
Well, they were massively oversold for a start. You know, the market cap was crazy considering some of the deals that they've got. You know, this is actually a company that's got a real social thing involved in it in terms of being able to produce very low cost housing for people in poorer countries. And if the finances come in for all of these different projects, it could absolutely rock it. I think it's only just begun, basically, is my view. And I'm actually working with a guy called Vilius. He's a guy from Finland, and he's actually doing a whole proposal at the minute with Eco Buildings to look at how we're going to get the funding involved for the different projects, like, because there's going to be special purpose vehicles for each one. So, yeah, watch this space for that. We've been doing quite a lot of work on it. I personally think it's a very honourable business, as well as being, it should be an incredibly profitable business as well. So it should be interesting.
Very good, yeah. Euro Metals as well, up some 100% on the week. We've not really looked at Euro, but what are your thoughts?
I know nothing about it other than there's been ramped to high heaven all week, which is good, but I don't know anything about it, so there's no point in me even saying that.
Yeah, it's the Zeb Nickel project in Mokopane in South Africa as well. They've just had a combined ground gravity and frequency domain electromagnetic survey over two priority targets at that. So it looks like things are moving at that project. We've also seen KEFI up some 50%, KEFI Gold and Copper. They announced that the signing of the $240 million debt financing for the Tulu Kapi Gold Project in Ethiopia is now expected this week. That was announced earlier in the week. So what are your thoughts?
Is that this week, this year, or this week in 2030?
Yeah, the joke of this, was it Charles saying it's only been 1,000 years in the making, this one? But
I genuinely hope for all shareholders it comes in. But I mean, yeah, there's been so many false dawns on this that I'm not in it, and I'm not struggling. I have no idea, really, to be honest. But I mean, listening to Colin Bird, and listening to the guys at Active Energy, I think, you know, there's some amazing opportunities going in there. You've got Bazan, you've got African Pioneer, you've got Galileo, you've got Extract, you've got Active Energy. All of those stocks, in my view, in the next few months and into next year are going to excel. They really are. I can't see how they're not. You know, we've had a bit of a wobble on the old Bitcoin as well. That's actually going to really help Amazing AI as they start to commit funds to buying the options on the Bitcoin. So rather than be buying at 115, 120, it looks like they're going to be, you know, 1.4 or below, which is what it is now as we record. So there is a lot of opportunities in the market. We need an update from Chill as well. I was speaking with Callum this week, so hopefully that's coming at some stage next week. I mean, we had a bit of a wobble on Friday, didn't we? But I think it started to recover even after we were recording. So there's a few people went to cash, I think, and you know, in the small cap market, when a few people run for the doors, then things wobble. But I think there's a long way to go. And even if we have a crash, I really do think that if you're into a resource space, stroke technology space, stroke AI in terms of that technology side of things, then even if there is a crash, I think it'll be very sharp V-shaped. It'll be down, and then people will start to realize, what on earth am I selling for? Because it's just a panic. And, you know, back up again. That's my view anyway. I could be wrong. I could be right. Let's see.
Yeah, sounds good. Anything planned for the weekend other than watching Liverpool United game?
Liverpool United.
On Sunday today at 4:30.
Do you reckon it's going to be 7-0 again or not?
Nah, well, maybe. You never know, do you? You never know. But should be an interesting one. We've got the Formula One as well, haven't we? We got the Texan, the US Grand Prix. We've got the sprint race on the Saturday, and then obviously the big race in the evening on the Sunday, because obviously the time delay, it's, I think it's like 8 p.m. this evening. I mean, it'd be interesting to see. I mean, obviously McLaren took the manufacturers, you know, six races remaining, and they've smashed it. Like, I don't think it's happened since, it's like 30, 40 years. In fact, it may have even been the first time it's ever happened. So be interesting to see the sort of showdown now between Piastri and Lando Norris. And also, like, Max, you can't rule Max out because he's actually still in contention to win the driver's title.
Yeah, he's by no means got the best car, and he's still there. So, I mean, it just shows what a great driver he is.
Amazing driver.
Anything but the Liverpool United one's going to be interesting because, you know, we've lost three on the bounce. You guys have actually won a few games.
You're going through a little bit of a lull, aren't you?
So we'll see what happens on Sunday. It could be interesting. I mean, I think if we really go for you, we'll absolutely destroy you. But at the same time, we haven't really done that this season yet. So we'll see. We'll see. We need a win. We need
absolutely
a win.
Well, if you do like what you've heard, please do subscribe, hit the bell icon so you get any future notifications of further episodes, and have a great weekend or what's left of it, and great Sunday. Thanks for listening.
Yep, thanks for listening, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.